welcome to the Curiosity of Podcast. It's only me here, as this is a short intro for an episode, or rather a talk, that we gave in 2023 at the Intelligent Speech Conference on the theme of contingency. And we tell the story of the Vavilov Institute. You can also watch this on YouTube, on the Intelligent Speech YouTube channel, which we'll have links to in the show notes if you want to see me and Anton and our presentation. We're also speaking at Intelligent Speech 2025, which takes place on the 8th of February, and this time the subject is deception. So we are busy beavering away on our topic at the moment. And you can find out more and buy tickets to Intelligent Speech 2025 at intelligentspeechonline.com. And if you use the promotional code Curiosity at checkout, you'll get 10% off. So make sure you go do that now, because you don't want to miss out, because there's loads of amazing speakers there, including one of my very favourite people, Fake History Hunter, who hopefully you know from Twitter and Blue Sky, and she's amazing, and she's going to be giving a talk. What other keynotes do we have? We've also got Wesley Livesey from the History of the Second World War podcast, and Otto English, who wrote Fake Heroes and Fake History. So really cool keynote speakers, and there's a lot of other great history podcasters going to be speaking as well, and we'll be there too. So I'm going to play their trailer in a minute. Then after that, we'll go straight into the recording from our talk in 2023, which the audio quality is a bit different to normal, as it was recorded live on Zoom. But please enjoy it. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Blue Sky, and go to our website. All the links are at thecuriosityofpod.com. Thank you very much.
Deception, lies, fakery, fraudulence, and forgery. This is what Intelligent Speech 2025 will be bringing to you.
My name is Otto English, and I will be talking about how bad history poisons politics for Intelligent Speech in 2025.
Hello, I'm Jo-Edwig Theuwissen. I'll be speaking at the Intelligent Speech 2025 about fake history, how to recognize it, and how to hunt it.
Hello everyone, my name is Wesley Livesey, and I'll be speaking at Intelligent Speech 2025 on the topic of sacrificed in the name of deception, when deception has a very real human cost.
Intelligent Speech 2025, Deception, will be taking place on the 8th of February 2025. Go to Intelligent Speech Online to find out more.
All right. Hi, welcome everyone. I think it's given about a minute for everyone to join. So I would just like to introduce Rick and Anton Lepetfin. They are the hosts of the podcast Curiosity of a Child, where they discuss everything from science and history to monsters and games. They look at the quirky to the unusual around the world, as well as seeking out local events, characters, and history and local history. So without further ado, I will hand it off to them.
Thank you very much, Eric. So I'm Rick. This is Anton.
Hello.
Hello. Anton's just recovering from the flu at the moment, so we're going to see how he does. So, contingency. When you hear that word, what do you think? I mean, what is a contingency plan? I think for most people, they think of something that allows you to keep going when your plans don't work or times are difficult. But what if you had a contingency plan that was bigger than you are? I mean, what are you going to do? Today, we've got two interlinked stories, and one is a sort of a big grand plan to secure global food security, and the other is a story of sacrifice, where the contingency plan is actually bigger than the people who take part in it.
It's winter of 1942. A cold, icy wind bites at your flesh. The temperature is below minus 30. It's too hard to walk to the food distribution kiosk. It's too dangerous. You've been surviving on 125 grams of bread a day. Calling it bread is generous. It's as much sawdust as flour. In a city with a population of over 3 million, thousands die daily. Of cold, of starvation, of war. You're so hungry your stomach aches. The pain is too great to bear. Your body is weak, frail. You don't recognise your face in the mirror, but you're surrounded by food. Crops and seeds from all over the world, potatoes, wheat, rice, peanuts. This isn't some hallucination brought on by the hunger. This is the largest collection of seeds and crops in the world. But you can't eat. You won't eat. No matter how much you and your colleagues suffer, this is the Babel of Institutes, and you have vowed to give your life in its defence. You would sooner starve than lose the genetic diversity, the rare plant breeds, the disease-resistant strains, the crops that will feed the future. All it will take is another 2 years of hunger and care for your most fragile of collections.
Yeah, thank you, Anton. So the Vavilov Institute of Plant Industry was founded in 1924 in Leningrad, which is St. Petersburg today. And its mission was to collect and study the world's plants, to breed new varieties and to also help safeguard food security. By the 1940s, it was the world's largest genetic seed bank, and actually it was also the first seed bank in the world, and it housed hundreds of thousands of samples from across the globe. Now, its founder was a man called Nikolai Vavilov, and he was one of the first scientists to recognise the importance of conserving the genetic material and biodiversity of plants. He was born in 1887 to a family of textile merchants, and he was a bright and curious boy, much like Anton. His love of nature was apparent from a young age, and he created his own herbarium to study plants. Now, he grew up in Russia, and as a young lad, he would have experienced a lot of famines, such as the devastating one of 1891 to 92. And I think through these experiences, it became his life's work to try and find a solution to hunger and famine. So as a young man, he actually went to study at the Moscow Agricultural Institute, and there he quickly made a name for himself. But as he was so curious, he decided that he wanted to diversify his knowledge, and he went to study in England. And there he would get exposed to other agricultural practices, and he visited William Bateson. Now, William Bateson, he is regarded as the father of genetics, so he would have learned a lot from him. However, whilst he was there, World War I broke out, so he needed to return to Russia. However, getting back, it wasn't all straightforward, because the ship carrying his baggage and all of his specimens that he collected was sunk when it hit a German mine. Now, it wasn't long until we came to the attention of Lenin once he returned back to Russia. And Lenin asked him to find ways to help reduce famine and to develop new crops that would grow well in Russia. Now, at the time, there's a desperate need for them to get more seeds to replace those that have been lost by famine and also to do more research. So they decided that a visit to America was the perfect opportunity for this. So they organised this visit to collect specimens and also go and talk to scientists and farmers there. At the time, the Soviet economy was in a mess, so Vavilov didn't have any money. So he actually took platinum ingots with him to sell instead. However, when he arrived in New York off the ship, it took like 2 or 3, 4 weeks to get across the Atlantic, I think. He wasn't allowed to enter the country because all of the passengers needed to have at least $300 on them. He was in luck, however, because his former brother-in-law was living in the city and managed to come down and help him. Whilst he was in America, Vavilov, he would collect 6,224 packets of seeds from 26 different companies, and he'd also meet lots of people there who would become close friends of his during his life. One of them was Luther Burbank, and when he visited his garden, he described it as a botanical fairyland. After his visit to America, returning to Russia, he stopped off in England for 3 days, where he would meet Bateson again. And he said of that meeting, "We talked about everything. A whole evening was talking about evolution. I guess it was the most substantial discussion of my trip." And so you can see all of his ideas starting to formulate here. Whilst he was there, he also collected more seed samples from around the world and realised that to really get a true understanding of the best crops and plants, the genetic diversity, he would have to launch expeditions of his own around the world.
In the 1920s and 30s, he traveled the world identifying what he called centres of origin, geographical regions where key food crops were first domesticated and their genes the richest. Expeditions were sent to over 60 countries with instructions to collect as many plants as possible. Vavilov was at the forefront. As much an explorer as a scientist, he learnt 22 languages. In Afghanistan, British officials thought Vavilov was a spy. His translator spent most of his time drunk, and he was useless and didn't even know Farsi, the language used by the local officials. So Vavilov needed to fix the situation himself. I immediately set about to perfect my own Farsi. I rose early in the mornings and memorized the boring Farsi grammar. This wasn't the only brush with danger. When the plane he was traveling in was forced to land in the Algerian desert, Vavilov used a torch from the campfire to fend off a rather curious lion. Another time, he collected wheat from Syria during an uprising against the French colonizers. From Spain to Ethiopia and Korea to Mexico, no place was left unsearched. He would talk with local farmers around the world, often traveling to remote locations by mule or on foot. His endless enthusiasm and energy was endearing to those he met. It's no wonder one of his favorite phrases was, "Hurry up, life is short." Vavilov's childhood herbarium would grow into the largest collection of plants and seeds in the world. By the 1930s, he was in charge of 400 research stations with 20,000 staff stretching the length of Russia. It was beyond anything in the West, and it wasn't just in Russia that his fame spread. He was made a member of international institutions across the globe. In 1938, a British team of scientists were tasked with leading the British Empire potato collecting expedition to discover new potato varieties. Who did they ask for advice? Vavilov, of course. He was the first to combine the skill of plant breeding with solid science and the understanding of genetics.
That's right. Now, within the walls of the Vavilov Institute, there's unknown value. The seeds they store might look ordinary, but they could hold the genes needed to fight the next deadly plague or blight that threatens to wipe out the food to feed a billion people. We only need to go back 170 years to the potato famine that raced across Europe, or more recently look at drought and climate change to see how vulnerable we really are. This collection, this life's work, is Vavilov's legacy. But we started with a story of starvation, hunger, a story of desperation. And this was the world against which Vavilov was fighting. He knew the importance of food security and protecting crops, including those that get lost during times of war. But the story isn't fiction, it's true. So let's head back to 1942 and remember those brave individuals who put us first. So the siege of Leningrad lasted 872 days, and the city was surrounded by German forces and was pretty much cut off. And to add to the misery, the winter of 1941-42 was the coldest recorded in the 20th century. In this chaos of war and cold, people would be surviving in the shells of bombed out buildings and scavenging what little they could to survive. An estimated 1 million civilians died. But inside one palatial building, right in the heart of the city, a small team of scientists barricaded the doors and the windows and hid from the world. This was the Vavilov Institute. They had no wood or coal and relied on burning furniture and debris that they found in the surrounding buildings to keep themselves warm and also their collection warm. They weren't fighters, they were botanists, and they were unprepared and untrained to fend off any looters. Inside the building were rows upon rows of seeds and grains and tubers and beans and crops from all around the world, and these needed 24-hour protection and careful maintenance. So the scientists, they split into teams to guard their collection and keep watch. And they were never allowed to be alone, just in case the temptation to eat became too strong. To make it easier, they moved the collection from 40 rooms to just 16 in the building, I think down in the basement, where it could be better tended to and also kept under lock and key. But starving rats would regularly run riot through the building and they would have to be fought off. So they got broken glass and stuffed into rat holes and laid poison in their desperate struggle to fight off these invaders. Many of the seeds had simply been stored in boxes, But these needed to be moved to more secure locations or put in metal tins and weighed down to stop the rats being able to get to them. Others were particularly vulnerable to the cold and damp conditions, such as potatoes, because you can't store those long term and they have to be regularly planted and harvested. Now, during peace times, they had land outside the city to do this and other research centres, but now they had to use any small plots that they could find in the city. And one was right on the outskirts of Leningrad, near the front line with the Germans. But with no machinery or animals, everything had to be dug out and ploughed by hand, all the time surrounded by fighting and shelling of the German forces. And also, unlike other citizens who might be planting food, knowing that they would have a reward for their hard work, the Vavilov Institute's researchers knew that theirs could not be eaten. I mean, how strong must have that temptation to eat been? And what did the citizens of the city think? Did they think that the botanists were keeping all the food in the building to themselves? 9 of the researchers would die during the siege. Here are some of their stories. Dmitry Ivanov, he was a specialist in rice, and he starved, surrounded by sacks of it, because he refused to eat from them. Alexander Shukin, he died at his desk, refusing to eat the peanuts in which he worked. One of the survivors said, "It was hard to wake up. It was hard to get on your feet and put your clothes on in the morning. But no, it was not hard to protect the seeds once you had your wits about you. Saving those seeds for future generations and helping the world recover after war was more important than a single person's comfort." But what of Vavilov?
His dream wasn't just to feed Russia. He wanted to feed the world. He called his work a mission for all humanity. But he was about to face his biggest struggle. In February 1935, Joseph Stalin praised Trofim Lysenko for his agricultural ideas. Where Vavilov was a pioneer in generic research and plant breeding, Lysenko was the opposite. He was a proponent of Lamarckism. That's the belief that to breed traits such as a resistance to cold, you need to grow plants in the cold. Put peas in the freezer and the plants you will grow will be frost resistant. Soon, we'll all be farming in the tundra. American cotton breeder F.C. Harland wrote this.
"I interviewed Lysenko for nearly 3 hours. I found him completely ignorant of the elementary principles of genetics and plant physiology. I can quite honestly say that to talk to Lysenko is like trying to explain differential calculus to a man who did not know his 12 times table. He was, in short, a biological circle squarer."
However, Lysenko's ideas fitted with Stalinist and communist ideologies. The suffering of the worker and the struggle to overcome adversity. It was much more appealing than the steady and measured way of Vavilov, slowly breeding for genetic traits. Unfortunately, it's also not true. It's a pseudoscience. But it fitted the party line. Politics are more important than science, and Lysenko was appointed director of the Institute of Genetics. Over the next few years, there were many debates and articles in the Soviet press as the two sides battled for the dominance of Soviet science, but with Stalin's support, there was only going to be one winner. Throughout this time, Vavilov tried to be tolerant, saying, "Young men like Lysenko, who walked by faith and not by sight, might even discover something." But he would not be successful. Hundreds of scientists were imprisoned if they refused to give up their belief in Darwinism and genetic inheritance. One of his victims was Vavilov, who Lysenko said was colluding with the enemy and trying to sabotage Soviet science.
That's right. And on the 6th of August 1940, Vavilov was arrested. A year later, he'd be sentenced to death on the grounds of high treason and espionage. But his belief was strong, and he publicly declared, "We will go to the pyre. We shall burn, but we shall not retreat from our convictions." Now, on the protests of his students and also many notable figures, his sentence was reduced to only 20 years in prison. He was a very well-known international figure, so the authorities were worried what might happen. And actually, the New York Times had falsely already reported on his death a year previously. so they were nervous about getting rid of him. But sadly, he had not even survived 3 years in prison, and he died on the 25th of January 1943 of starvation. Now, Lysenko's flawed ideas and agricultural methods, they became a major cause of the terrible crop failures that would kill millions of people in the Soviet Union and China. In the 1960s, however, Vavilov's name was cleared and his reputation was rehabilitated within the Soviet Union. But if you think about it, how different might the world have been today if Vavilov's principles had prevailed and not Lysenko's? If politics hadn't mixed with science, would this amazing, passionate and intelligent man have been able to make the changes to the world that he really wanted? Would he have been able to continue? Now, his good friend and the Nobel Prize winner, Hermann Joseph Müller, wrote of him, "He was a truly great man in very varied respects, scientific, administrative, human. He is more life-loving, life-giving and life-building than anyone else I've ever known." Now, today, he's little known, particularly in the West, although the Institute still bears his name in St. Petersburg. But he was once one of the leading global figures in plant genetics, breeding and security. And his fate was lost to the West until the fall of the Iron Curtain. Some people today say that he should be seen as important as Charles Darwin and also be as well known. And when he released his key findings on plant genetics, it was hailed at the time as important as Mendeleev's discovery of the periodic table. It's Nikolai Vavilov. He was one of the first people to see the importance to understanding the diversity of the natural world and to keep it safe for future generations so that we might overcome potential future famines and plagues and crop failure. But in a way, his legacy still does live on because many of the species that he discovered and the genes that he collected and helped protect have been bred into many of the crops that we all eat globally today. Vavilov, he wanted to feed the billions of people who inhabit our precious planet. And his belief and his character were so strong that his colleagues were willing to give up their lives, to literally starve to death, surrounded by food, and to make his dream a reality. And that is the end. So thank you very much.
All right. That was awesome. I have never heard of that before. And that was very interesting. So with that, we will open it up to questions if anybody does have one. I did think of a few when I was on there. So if anyone would like, please put it in the chat, or there is a Q&A function if you would like to use that. So I guess while we're waiting for those questions to pop up, I guess I had just a couple of things. This seems like a very elementary question, but when he was in America and he was traveling the world collecting these seeds, is he going to universities? Is he just like stopping by sides of the roads because that looks interesting? Like, how was he collecting these?
Well, he was really at the forefront. So he would do everything he could really to collect them. He would go visit leading figures in genetics and agriculture in universities, say in America and the UK particularly. But he would also go out into the field, and he'd be traveling by mule into the remote Afghani mountains looking for new crops and seeds there and bringing them back. But then he would also make a lot of connections. So the British potato expedition, that one in particular, but when one young British scientist went over to meet Vavilov in Russia, Vavilov said, "Look, any potatoes you find, I expect you to find at least 30 new varieties. I want you to send samples back to me." So he absolutely every way that he could attempt to find information, he would, whether it's in the field, talking to local farmers. Like Anton said, he learned 22 languages, which is incredible. So he could actually speak to people firsthand. He really valued that first-hand knowledge. He saw that with his centres of diversity, which are a lot of the cradles of civilization, he saw that those thousands of years of agriculture that had happened there were was really valuable knowledge, and that we couldn't just have like this monocultures.
Yeah. Well, good. So Sydney asks, prior to Lysenko coming into the picture, did Vavilov ever have the support of the Russian government, or was this completely on his own account?
He did have some support early on, but I don't think he ever probably got the full support he wanted. Under Lenin, he did. Because Lenin was, I think, more of a proponent of that type of science. But under Stalin, it really started to disintegrate. Because Vavilov, he was, I think, like we said, made like an honorary member of a lot of international institutions, like the Royal Society and all different bodies around the world. I mean, there's a list of like 20 of them. So that's how well-known he was. And he... I'm just thinking.
No worries.
He got the support there, and there was a plan to have like the World's Genetic Conference. I think I can't remember exactly what it's called. It's going to be held in Russia in 1937. But unfortunately, Stalin had come to power here, and the fight with Lysenko had also started, and it's filling up the press and the news and everything. And he steadily, over a period of 7, 8, 9 years, seemed to lose more and more support from the Soviet government as Lysenko was getting more protection. And at first, he was very sort of careful and not exactly supportive of Lysenko, but he didn't just want to write him off. He was trying to carefully deal with him. So he lost support long term.
Sure. Did you ever come across, before Lysenko became got the ear of the government, did those two ever meet? Did they have any correspondence, or were they just in separate spheres?
Lysenko and Vavilov?
Yes.
Yeah, they did meet. So Vavilov was older than Lysenko, and Vavilov whilst he was on expeditions all the time, he was headquarters in St. Petersburg today, but Lysenko, he was actually Ukrainian, so he was in Ukraine. And Vavilov would go to Lysenko's sort of research facility, and they'd meet there. And I think Lysenko also went to Vavilov's, and they never saw eye to eye, and they never got on. And so they did. They were aware of one another and battled in the press and all sorts as well.
Okay.
And also that different, when Stalin announced, I think in 1935, like he got up and basically clapped his hand saying how good Lysenko's policies and ideas were, his flawed ideas. Vavilov was in the audience then as well, and at different conferences that they were holding in the country. So yeah, they worked very in the same sphere, but can't exactly say close together.
Right. So would you say, so again, that in that conference where Lysenko's getting this praise, is Vavilov just like biting his tongue? Does he dare say anything like, no, this guy wants us to freeze things so that they grow in the winter? Like, what does that correspondence look like?
He's usually bites his tongue there. There were times where he couldn't, like, particularly towards the end, where I think he realized that his time was up, really. He had seen friends taken away to the gulag or executed. And I think some of it was just his fame that's keeping him safe. And he would also he'd have lots of people coming over to visit him. Like he'd have, I can't remember their names, unfortunately, but he'd have famous people like scientists from America and England coming to visit him. And some would stay with him for years, like Müller. He worked with him for many, many years then. Like Vavilov basically told him he's got to get out for his own protection. But then at one of the conferences, the ideologies, like the political ones, really got, unfortunately, ingrained with the science here. So they started arguing about are Lysenko's policies or Vavilov's the more fascist, and which was the more, obviously, they're fighting the Germans and Nazism, which is very opposed to the communist ideas. So they were, arguing over that. And then one of the American scientists came over and started saying that Lysenko, he's the one who's, his ideas are most along these lines, and that might have actually been another nail in the coffin, unfortunately, of Vavilov. But he was so fed up with just like the craziness of the direction that they were taking, and that all the evidence was saying, look, what Vavilov's doing is right and seems to be the right direction, and what Lysenko's doing, he's had like one success, nothing else has been seen to be a success. So yeah.
Great. I would like to see if go ahead and go freeze some peas in some freezers and see if that works out for you, but good luck. Yeah. So Sydney, he says, you mentioned China adopted Lysenko's policy. How long did it take for people to realize the consequences, do a ban, and then abandon his strategy?
I don't know the exact time period, but it was, I think it was a good 30 years that they're probably using Lysenko's. I'm trying to think when the bad famines were. Because when Khrushchev came to power, that was, and I think it's the mid-1960s when Vavilov started to, his name was held in high regard again. After more failed famines, they realized that what Lysenko was doing just wasn't right. So I think, yeah, 25, 30 years maybe. So it was a long time.
I can only imagine the amount of failure.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to just talk about during the siege, when they're protecting these seeds, do you know, like, how well known was it to the public? Because it feels like this would be a big, like, opportunity for people to just storm the castle, so to say, and to just take what they need. Was there any, like, near break-ins? Did the public really know what was in the building or where he was stationed at?
I couldn't find any specific details on that. So Vavilov himself wasn't there. He was already in prison at the time. So just the researchers were there. But everything I read was more about the rats being a problem rather than people breaking in. Because I don't know how much people know what's actually going on inside these different institutions. Because I think today you might know that there's a building that does some form of science, but you don't really know what they hold. But they must have seen them going out when they're planting the crops. I don't know how they defended these fields of potatoes that they planted on the front line. So because people were, well, millions of people starving. So it doesn't matter how nice you are, you're going to want to dig those up and eat them. It's desperation at that stage.
So then do you get the sense that Stalin had an idea of how many seeds he was storing, or like, why wasn't he able to say, go take all of those right now?
Yeah, that's a funny one, that, because he was past his, Vavilov was past his height of respect, yet this institute still survives. So I think there was an idea from Stalin or the powers who be that it was still an important institute. Because I know that, well, I read that Hitler had planned raids with commandos to steal the seeds because he saw the value, because he thought he'd need those in the future to feed his long-term plans to dominate everyone. But actually, the institute was a little bit lucky because where it was positioned in the city was near the Astoria Hotel, where Hitler had planned his victory party. Oh. So they didn't shell the region too much. So that helped the institute survive.
Okay. That's incredibly good luck. Goodness.
Yeah.
I guess as soon as the Soviet wall fell, could you just kind of tell of his impact? Like, are there any other Vavilovs that like are kind of carrying his torch, or like even in his time period, were there other countries? I know China went with Lysenko, but were there other countries that were kind of using his work and then growing it elsewhere outside of Russia?
Well, yeah, he was always incredibly open to communication with other countries. And that's, I think, part of his downfall with Stalin and Lysenko. They were saying that he's talking too much with these people and he's spending too much time out of the country on all these expeditions. So there's a lot of people supporting it, like the British Potato Expedition. They went to him because he was the man to go to with all of this knowledge. So I think that's one of the positive things that we can always take, which is why I like the sciences, is often you have these figures who, for them, it's that love of knowledge and that curiosity, which means that they're not interested in politics, they're not interested in the money or the fame. For them, it's what can we learn and what can we share? Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the takeaways that I want people to take, is that when you get these individuals, they are willing to look at a bigger picture than just, oh, well, our government's doing this or saying that or our people. It's about the big picture and everybody in the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any... Did Vavilov ever like write a journal while he was in prison? Or I'm assuming that probably got taken away, but is there any surviving documents as he was in prison just to kind of give his internal thoughts?
I haven't come across any, actually. Although I did find a book about him, but a little bit too late. I've had another book, so I haven't been able to read it all. So there might be some. But I imagine a lot, sadly, would have been, taken away or destroyed. He did write letters to his friends, actually. From there, that might be before he's in prison. So he did, and he had a coded message, like one of his friends in America, his son wanted to come and study under Vavilov. And he had a coded message in the letter saying, look, if you receive this from me, don't send your son, it's too dangerous.
Oh, well, the brave man. All right.
Yeah.
So I think with that, I'm not seeing any more questions come through. I do think we have about 5 minutes, so instead of going off on a tangent that we might go over time, I think this might be a good stopping point. So with Anton, thank you so much for presenting for us today. We really appreciate it. It was very interesting. I never thought that learning about potato seeds and different varieties of that would be interesting. So, or how you can tie that to Stalinism. So that was a heck of a leap. But no, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that talk, and remember, go to intelligentspeechonline.com to get tickets for the 2025 Intelligent Speech, which is happening on the 8th of February, and use the promotional code Curiosity at checkout, and hopefully we will return to some more regular releases soon. I've been reading lots of books, and I've got probably 3 or 4 episodes in progress. I just haven't had time to get them released, and I should have Anton back with me as well then, because it's much better with him. Okay, thank you. Goodbye.